Okay, morning everyone. And big welcome back to Colleen, Sarah. Everyone has been away. So this is the final week of this term in the series. Towards the end of today's session, we're going to draw the raffle, as we always do. Next term, we're going to start a whole new topic. I'm actually planning something a bit different and exciting, hopefully. But I'll let you know in the next few days, or by WhatsApp, by email. But the Thursday will be the 21st of July. So that's three Thursdays from now, I think. Not next week, not the week after, the week after that. Okay. So we've been discussing the last couple of weeks the topic of resilience. Last week we focused on resilience that comes from failing, right? Because different types of resilience. Resilience from external hardship or challenge. Resilience from internal failure or things that we do wrong and so on, making mistakes. And last week we had a discussion. We based it on an article from Dr. David Pelkowitz. Talked about the three things. One is, number one, accepting responsibility, which is a hard thing to do, but liberating and feeds the concept of resilience. The courage to apologize, to acknowledge mistakes, and to apologize to those who we need to apologize to. And then a plan, commitment to change, right? So we learn, which includes learning from others, even those that are less than us. He brought that research study from doctors who made mistakes, and the ones who became better doctors were the ones who did, who asked and explored, and even asked nurses and patients and things what they could do better and so on. And in general, we discussed the concept of making failure part of the journey of growth. So we can fail and it can be an interruption and a waste of time because we didn't do anything with it, or we can take failure and turn it into a catalyst of growth, and therefore becomes part of the journey. And of course, from a Jewish point of view, we have the idea of Yerida Tzorech Aliyah, which means that the descent is from the purpose of ascent, which means that the purpose of failure is not just to bounce back and to become as we were before, but to become better than we were before. In other words, so it becomes deeper and better, so that the failure actually becomes part of the journey of growth, part of the building blocks of growth, and we'll see a bit more later about that as well. So today, just to end off, I want to do two things, first, which are connected. First, I want to focus on just another concept, a few other concepts to do with resilience, particularly in the area which we spoke about, this idea of practicing resilience when things are not challenging, right? We spoke about this concept that resilience is much better applied when we practice it when we don't need it so much, right? And that's like everything. When we practice it when we don't need it, then we have the tools and the readiness and the strength to apply it when we do need it, right? As we explained. Also, in the context of the discussion of resilience and looking at things positively and optimism and bouncing back, I want to dedicate part of today's shiur to a great leader. I would say he was my mentor, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because his yahrzeit, his 28th yahrzeit, is this Shabbos, the third day of Tammuz. And he embodied the mindset of resilience to an extreme. I think it would be great to sort of just draw on some stories from him. You know, my connection with him obviously is just not just as a global leader, but quite personal. Studied a number of years in his yeshiva, listened to hours, hundreds of hours of his talks. When I was 13, actually, when he was still doing that, I had the, just after my bar mitzvah, I had the tremendous schut, the tremendous merit to actually have a private audience with him, just me and him, which was quite interesting. There was a trip that my grandfather took me to, as a present for my mitzvah, he took me to New York. And what happened was that he, normally when family would come, they were going together, but because he was a communal rabbi and had things which were very of confidential nature to discuss with the rabbi, so we decided that he would go in and I would go in afterwards. So it was just me, and he gave me a very beautiful blessing at the time. A blessing that, in fact, really served as a lot of the inspiration to create Bina, really, which was about learning and progressing in learning and teaching and so on and so forth. So in honor of his 20th yahrzeit, I want to dedicate some of today, but in the context of the discussion which we've been having. So first of all, I want to draw some inspiration from a different article that I told you about, the booklet I was reading about articles on resilience, and very much has to do with practicing and building up the mindset of positivity and resilience and strength and so on. And this is an article from, I can never pronounce her name, but it's, I've mentioned her a number of times. She's an expert on the topic of happiness. Sonia, no? What's the next word? Libra Mirsky or something. Some Russian name, I don't know, I can never pronounce it. Okay. So she talks about holding on to happiness when the world collapses, right? But the whole article is about not how you hold on to happiness when everything collapses. It's more how you cultivate the mindset of happiness when things don't collapse, so that you should have the tools to do it when they do collapse, right? That's the concept which we've been discussing. And she says that research has revealed that the key to a happy life is to experience bursts of positive emotion throughout the day, right? This is her thing. Because she says positive emotions don't just make us feel good, they broaden our horizons and build our social, physical, and intellectual skills. An avalanche of studies has shown that happy moments and uplifts, no matter what their source, lead us to be more sociable, more likable, more productive, and more energetic, and so on and so forth, right? So what she does is she says this is evidence-based. She presents a program for a four-week guide, and she recommends that each week a person should practice three things, which she outlines, and I'm just going to run through these things with you because they're very beautiful. I don't think it has to necessarily be in that order or necessarily over 4 weeks. They're just 12 really, really good tools, right? So in week one, she says, and she's very big on this, of course, and we've talked about this once before, the practicing of gratitude, right? Just always, just and as we've said many times, gratitude is a verb, it's not a noun, right? It's something you have to actually practice, something you have to actually put work into feeling and verbalizing and practicing it every day, right? And she writes that it's one of the best antidotes to negative emotions like fear and dismay. When we don't take things for granted, when we highlight things that are going well, right, it's very, very powerful if we do that every day. Obviously, as we've said many times in the Jewish practice, we have that inbuilt practice of what we call the morning brachot. First of all, the Modei Ani prayer, which is obviously a prayer of gratitude, and also then what follows, the morning brachot, which is just to highlight the things that God gives us every day, the gifts, the normal gifts, not the amazing things, just normal stuff, like being able to walk and things like that. And those blessings are said every day. Obviously, it's not enough to say them. They have to be said with a bit of focus and intention. And, you know, sometimes early in the morning when you rush, it's very easy just to rattle them off. And obviously, that defeats the purpose to some degree. But it highlights that concept of practicing gratitude. Then she talks about optimism, right? She says you need to practice optimism. Now, how do you practice optimism? Now, it's true that some people are just naturally more optimistic than others. That's clear. As it is with resilience, some people are just more naturally resilient than others. But like resilience that can be taught and learned, so could optimism. Martin Seligman has a whole book called Learned Optimism, right? He's the father of positive psychology. So, learned optimism. And the way she suggests you do it is a very simple thing. Every time there's something you look at negative, every time there's something bad that happens or annoying or inconvenient, whatever the case is, stop, or just do this 2-3 times a day. Stop and force yourself to look at the brighter side of things. So what's the silver lining? What good can come out of this? What possible positive could there be? All right? So it's those kind of things. You know, there's a, talking about stories of the Rebbe, there's a story of one woman who went to, her name is Mrs. Groner, she went to Shlichut, she went and set up a Chabad center in North Carolina. And this is years, years, years back. And the first few years, you know, always go difficult. That's what it is. When you start something new, it's not easy, right? So she was doing some good things, and she would update the Rebbe every few months about stuff that she's done and so on. But on a mega level, it just seemed to be very, very tough. So one day, you know, she almost like says, no, this is not for me kind of thing, right? So she sits down, she writes a letter to the Rebbe, which he acknowledged years later was somewhat chutzpahdik, as they say. And she's asked the Rebbe about all the things that are wrong. And she ends off the letter by saying, it's just a mess. That's what she wrote. She wrote in English. It's just a mess. Right? So the Rebbe would often answer letters, not by writing another letter, but by actually just making a note on the person's note. right? And incorporate some of the words of the person. So there were writes on the side of the thing that I really am battling to understand what you're writing. He says, he had no patience for negativity general. That was one of the underlying things. He says, I really don't understand what you're writing. You wrote to me previously about a class that you taught, about an influence that you had on someone, about inspiration that you managed to inspire a few people to do another mitzvah, or whatever the case is. He cited a few examples of reports that he had received from her about the good things that she had done. And he says, in Hebrew, he answered, velozeh, and this korim, you call this, and then he circled the whole line, mess. Velozeh korim mess, this is what you call a mess? Question mark, exclamation mark kind of thing, right? In other words, what are you talking about? You're just looking at the wrong things, right? Is it difficult? Of course it's difficult. Life comes with difficulty, but it's a matter of what we choose to focus on, right? So, practicing optimism is one of the things that Sonia, whatever her last name is, says that we should, Sonia L, that's it, very good. Says that we should learn to practice every day, which actually means consciously looking at something which we naturally look at negative and then saying, okay, so what's the positive here? And by the way, as we've said many times, look at when you highlight what the positive is, it doesn't mean the negative doesn't exist, right? That's not what it means. It doesn't mean that it's positive and not negative. Because things come with challenges. That's what we've been talking about for the last few weeks. It just highlights what we choose to focus on and what we're going to channel and what we're going to invest on. Is it going to be the challenges or is it going to be the good things, right? This is the practice. This is the exercise which you have to learn. It's not an easy exercise, but it's powerful. It's very, very powerful. And it's something we just need to do when small negative things happen. It just has to be big disasters. It just has to be small negative things. Something that we just get very annoyed about and we stop and say, okay, so what's the good side of it? It's a very powerful thing. And then she also talks about appreciating our senses, which are kind of a consciousness, to like, you know, appreciate that we smell, we eat. You can do this by tasting food or whatever the case is. And I think that links in to what we talked about before, the Birchot HaShachar, the morning blessings, where we talk about the ability to have clothing, to wear, to walk, to sit, and so on and so forth. So it's about being, it's also an awareness, right? A lot of this is an awareness of the greatness and gifts of life. Like, how many of us actually, you know, suddenly think during the day, you know, I'm breathing, which is an amazing thing, right? Do you ever do that? We don't, right? Unless you have a cold, of course, but right? Then suddenly we become aware of how we're breathing, right? And the same thing, like that we smell good things, or it's a nice day, or it's a sunny day. We don't often just take things for granted, right? It's like, you know, overseas I've been there. Especially when things happen all the time, right? So you don't take things for granted. Like overseas, I've often had this experience where, you know, someone says, where do you live? I say, Sydney. Oh, Sydney, wow, those beaches are amazing. Like, don't you walk in every morning and just marvel at the beauty? I said, actually, no, I just walk in the morning and go to work. Right? But it's true. It's a beautiful city. It is true, right? So, you know, it's about cultivating awareness, right? So that's for week one. So week two is... and then I think this is really important because we know that the body and soul work together. So week two, she says, you've got to make time for health. You've got to make time for exercise. She calls it simply make a move. Start moving, start walking, start doing something. Because we know that research tells us that it improves our mood, our spiritual welfare, our emotional welfare. There's a famous Hasidic saying. It's in Yiddish. I'll say it in Yiddish and I'll translate it. As a kleiner loch in guf is a greiser loch in the neshama. That a small hole in the body creates a big hole in the soul, which is interesting because God created us as a combination between body and soul. So therefore, if we want to talk about growing as a person, we want to talk about being more positive, being better, being resilient, having more faith, things we talked about last week, believing in Hashgacha Pratit, everything, all these things are much easier done when we actually feel better. So that's the body and the soul need to go together. The Rambam, of course, tells us that liyot haguf barit, for the body to be healthy, one must look at it as, because he has a whole section where he talks about diet and exercise and things, right, in his magnum opus, is when he goes through all the laws of the Torah. One section is dedicated to physical well-being and health and diet and so on. And he prefaces it by saying, liyot haguf bari, for the body to be healthy, is part of avodat Hashem. It's part of serving God, right? So from a Jewish perspective, it's a very important thing. And it's not just a good idea, it's actually part of divine service. And that has to be part of the picture. Then, of course, something which comes up in research all the time, which is we need to do acts of kindness. Doing acts of kindness makes us happy. And that's obviously, so many people talk about that. And it's interesting because this is what we've spoken about many times, that doing acts of kindness allows us to go beyond ourselves. When we go beyond ourselves, we're able to appreciate true joy. When we focus on ourselves all the time, what we experience is pleasure, not joy. Right? Because we do things that are good for us and feel good. Real joy comes from giving. Real joy comes from meaning. Real joy comes from selflessness, inner fulfillment, and so on and so forth. And there are six steps, interesting one. I think she wrote this before the mindfulness language became very popular, but it's the same thing, really. She has become absorbed in what you do. Right? When you're so fully engaged in what you're doing, you don't notice the passage of time. You're in a state called the flow. And she recommends try have two flow experiences every day. In other words, just to take something you're doing and be fully there, and be fully, really present. Because this, that's a healthy way of life. It takes away fragmentation, it takes away distraction, it takes away all being all over the place, and so on and so on and so forth. I think I mentioned this to you once, that there was a great sage who lived in, I think, the 12th, 13th century, Rabbeinu Bechaya, a great Kabbalist, and he composed a prayer, which was interesting that prayer applied then. I started to think how much it needs to apply today. It was a four-word prayer, which he composed himself. He said, Hashem Yatzileini Mepizur HaNefesh. God, please save me from the fragmentation of the mind, of the soul. Right? Because one of the great sources of frustration and stress, and sometimes even anxiety, is the mind being all over the place and not focused. That's why it's really important for us. And today this is so evident, right? That's why so much anxiety, so much stress, because we're all over the place. We're not slow, we're not focused, right? We're not present enough. And that's why we need to actually practice that being present, and that's one of her exercises that she recommends. Sure, please.
So with the acts of kindness, what if it's not appreciated?
That's interesting one. Well, I mean, it depends. You see, I mean, it depends on the exact specific case. Like, sometimes there are people who don't appreciate it for different reasons. Either they don't appreciate it because they don't care about you. That could be. And maybe you need to look at other areas of kindness. But sometimes we do kindness to be, we help people because they're in a state of mind that they really don't appreciate it, but because they can't. They're struggling, right? And we help them because it's the right thing to do, right? I'm trying to think of an example. So someone, I don't know, you might know of a family. I'm just thinking of the first example that comes to mind. Might be a family that says a dysfunctional family where parents can't cope, where they have neglect or whatever the case is, right? And you help them out and you don't get the appreciation you should be getting. That's because they're dysfunctional people, right? But we're helping them because it's good for them and ultimately good for the kids and so on and so forth. So that's real selfless kindness in a way. That's even better. Now, it's always good to be appreciated, of course. Always good to get, just like it's important to show gratitude, it's important to receive gratitude as well. But sometimes we do acts of selfless kindness, and selfless kindness could be sometimes when it's the right thing to do, but it's not appreciated. Right? Now, sometimes when it's not appreciated, then it's not the right thing either, because sometimes kindness builds connection. And builds connection often builds relationships. And sometimes that act of kindness to someone who just doesn't care, it's not achieving the same thing, right? It's not achieving that connection. So therefore, maybe it's not the right thing. But it's really case by case. But sometimes it is the right thing to continue to do that because just the right thing to do. Because when we give, it's about us giving, not so much about the other person receiving. You know, it's very interesting. There's a halachic dispute. You know, on Purim, right? There's the mitzvah of mishloach manot, of giving gifts to others, right? And there's the famous halachic debate, which I won't go into now in detail. I'm just mentioning it because of the question you asked. About what's actually the mitzvah? Is it to give or is it to be received? And there's different explanations of why. And the difference would be, let's say I gave someone mishloach manot on Purim and they weren't home, so they didn't even get to know about it until after Purim. Did I fulfill the mitzvah, right? And that kind of thing. But it highlights, so that's a halachic analysis thing, which is interesting, but it highlights that concept also. There's two parts of giving. One is the importance of giving. One is it being received and appreciated. But sometimes it doesn't matter if it's not. It's about me. It's about me giving. Similar to something we once discussed, you remember, about the prayer of forgiveness before we go to sleep, right? Which is an interesting thing. There's a prayer of forgiveness where we forgive people before we go to sleep, but the people who we forgive don't know about it. Now, maybe eventually they will, but it's good for us because we let go of toxicity, we let go of ourselves, we let go of being trapped. So, yeah, so I think the answer to the question is that sometimes, yes, it's good even to give, even though it's not appreciated. But it depends on what the particular context of the giving is. Yeah. It's an interesting question. So, moving on to her week three, step seven is laugh and smile. Right? Nowadays, they have a thing called laughter therapy. But again, in Judaism, this is an old concept. The physical act of laughing or dancing or smiling brings feeling of positivity, right? Now, as we explained once, to be happy doesn't mean to dance and sing. Oh, happiness is a constant state of mind, right? But dancing and singing, for example, or laughing, these are highlighted or emphasized experiences of happiness, and we need them once in a while. Because although we're supposed to be happy all the time, as King David says in Psalms, Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, you've got to serve God with joy, right? Serve God with joy, which means we're always supposed to serve God, so therefore we're always supposed to be joyous. In other words, we're supposed to find happiness in everything that we do. When I was very young, my grandfather told me a story once, I'll never forget it. He told me this little story about, in a few weeks, in about 2 months, there's this day called Tisha B'Av, which is the day we mourn the destruction of the temple. And it's quite a sad day. It's a day where we mourn destruction of the temple and other tragedies that happened to the Jewish people throughout the ages, and the kinds of laws that we sit on low stool and we sing sad songs and we read sad passages and so on and so forth, right? So there's a bunch of different things that we do. We fast and we sort of, it's like mourning, like laws of mourning. So it says, he told me once, there was a Hasidic Rebbe that on Tisha B'Av, he was doing all the particular laws. He was observing Tisha B'Av properly, but he was like doing it quite happily. He was in a good mood. So someone said to him, Rabbi, it's Tisha B'Av. What's the celebration for today? He said, well, to mourn for Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple and to observe Tisha B'Av is a mitzvah. And every mitzvah you have to do with joy. Right? So there's a depth behind that. In other words, it's the concept of even when it's not joyous, but we have to do it with joy on some level, because everything we have to find happiness in the meaning and the purpose. But nevertheless, there's great merit in emphasized experiences of happiness. That's why we have Simchat Torah, where we dance, we have Purim, we have weddings, we have all kinds of things that we do where we engage in actual happiness, in acts of happiness, in experiences of happiness. Because as we know, in Jewish tradition, we have the fundamental principle which we've mentioned 1,000 times, that the heart follows the action. Right? So very, very often, acts of happiness, which has now become part of modern-day research, but it's always been there in Jewish thinking, that the things that we do influence the way we feel. And therefore, laughing once in a while, smiling, being happy, making sure that we do those kind of things actually has an effect on our overall positive mood. Then she talks about step eight, which she says we need to go out of our way to actually consciously show genuine interest in others. Now, this is an interesting thing. In the week, in her week two program, she talks about doing kindness. Now, doing kindness is the action of kindness. But it's not enough. It's true, it's not enough. Action of kindness is a good thing. It certainly allows us to go beyond ourselves. It certainly allows us to cultivate that inner happiness which comes from meaning, which comes from giving. But also there's the idea of showing genuine interest in other people. And that's I just want to stop there for a second, because I think I've talked about this before, but it's a very important thing. That's something that research shows is on the decline, actually, right, nowadays. People are not showing enough interest in other people, meaning genuine interest, that I really care about what's happening to you. I'm really listening and paying attention. And one of the reasons, of course, is technology, because we're paying attention to this instead of paying attention to other people, right? This happens in relationships, this happens in friendships, this happens in lots of cases. And that damages the levels of empathy that we're able to experience and interest that we're able to have and connection and deeper connection and so on and so forth. Which we know that if we don't have deep relationships, we don't have deep connections, that affects our happiness, it affects our emotions, it affects our positivity. So therefore, interesting that she's isolated this as an exercise, which is really good, is to actually consciously make sure, are we genuinely showing an interest in another person, right? Are we finding out what's really happening in another person's world? There's a famous little anecdote from, I think it's Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Baditcher, the Baditcher Rebbe, who I've mentioned a number of times. So he said that he learned true love for another person. There's a mitzvah in the Torah, V'haftal recha kamocha, right? loving someone like yourself and so on. So he said he learned how to do it from a drunk in an inn. So I asked him, well, what do you mean? He says he was traveling one night. And you know, in the old shtetl, he used to stay over in a hotel, which also served as like a tavern, a bar, whatever. And he said he overheard two, Polish, Russian peasants having a conversation. They were both stone drunk. And the one guy says to his friend, Ivan, you love me? He says, of course I love you. Like in his drunken stoop. He says, no, you don't love me. And this like repeated itself like a few times. You love me? He says, of course I love you. No, you don't love me. Right? And he's hearing this conversation. He's very interested. So eventually the guy who's asking the question, he says, you know what? If you love me, how come you don't know what's hurting me? What's hurting me? What I'm missing? Right? So he said he learned true Avat Yisrael. He said he learned from a drunk in an inn. Right? But how do you do that? That's only if... That's true connection. But true connection only comes knowing what's hurting, how the other person is hurting, or what they're missing, or what they're lacking, is by paying attention to the other person, by showing an interest in the other person. And the interesting research is that this has real effect on our own well-being, on our own positivity. It builds connection, and that connection is good for us. So there's a selfish motive here, not just the other person, right? But it comes from true selflessness. In other words, if you really show an interest in other people, it has a tremendous impact on the way we feel, which is amazing. She talks about also the power of reminiscing. Sometimes when we just, you know, things are a bit low, just to think about things that have happened, just to imagine things that have happened in the past. Viktor Frankl talks about this actually. He one of the things that got him through the camps was he used to imagine himself in the classroom teaching and so on, just to reminisce in good times, because you transport yourself to good things once in a while. The Baal Shem Tov said, "Bemakom shemachshavto shel adam," in the place that the thought of a person is, "Sham hu nimtza," that's where he is. A person is where his thoughts are, right? It's not always a good thing, by the way. Sometimes that's a bad thing. A person is very distracted, right? I think I told you the story about a rabbi that went over to a congregant that was saying the Amidah. He was praying, and when he finished the Amidah, he said to him, "Welcome home." He says to him, "What do you mean? I wasn't away. Maybe you got the wrong guy." He says, "No, I noticed that when you were davening, when you were praying the Amidah, the first part you were in Israel, the second part you were in New York, the third part you were somewhere else, right? So welcome home, you know." So letting our thoughts wander is not such a good thing, but it has a positive thing to it also, that sometimes it's good just to reminisce about something, right? And then finally, the last thing she talks about, transport yourself with your senses. So I guess that's a deeper part of reminiscing, where you actually try and sort of, you know, sometimes smell reminds you of a certain thing, and you take senses and you remind yourself of certain good things. Connecting with someone, which is similar to paying an interest, but then leads to a deeper connection. And her last one is, celebrate your successes, which is such an important thing, because we don't do that enough. And I don't mean to do that in a selfish way or an arrogant way. But we do tend to beat ourselves up, and that's a big problem. And we don't celebrate, or we don't highlight the small steps that we make and the small successes that we have in our growth and our positivity and so on, right? So if we finish a day and maybe we've been grumpy lately and we're seeing the negative and we're looking at all the bad things, but today was a little bit of a better day, you know, that I actually managed to find the silver lining in something while looking at something more positively, we need to celebrate that. Because before we go to sleep at night, from a Jewish point of view, there's the concept of saying the Shema, right? The bedtime Shema before we go to sleep at night, and the sources tell us that that's a time that we're supposed to reflect on a day, yeah? And we're supposed to do what's called a cheshbon. We're supposed to like do a reckoning for the day, just like we do in Elul for the whole year. But as Rabbi Tversky says, that a true cheshbon, a true reckoning, a true audit of your day must include both sides, must include the negative and the positive. So yes, a true audit means I'm honest with myself and I know the things I messed up on and I take responsibility for them and I pledge and commit to do better in the future, but it also has to include the successes of the day, right? As he says, if you only focus on the negatives, you're not doing a proper order. You're just you're sweeping a chimney. You know, that's it. Like, you're sweeping out all the mess. But that's not a cheshbon. That's not a proper audit. Proper audit is to get the full picture. I've made progress. Things are good. There's positives, and that allows me to be positive. So I just thought I'd share with you. I thought it was very beautiful. Those 12 things, sort of that we can practice, practical things that actually put us in a. But again, I want to emphasize, these are the things we should be doing when things are going well. When just things, life is going normal, right? Because the more we do these things as life is traveling its normal course, the more we have the tools to do it when we have those bigger bumps in the journey. Now, one of the things that we know, of course, that all this happens from, I just want to mention this very briefly, staying strong and even when things are challenging and bouncing back and having hope and cultivating optimism and so on, is to believe that it's possible. I saw a beautiful little article by someone called, I can pronounce her name, Ellen Galinsky, where she developed something a little bit like Carol Dweck. Remember Carol Dweck, who had the fixed mindset and the growth mindset? So she talks about the adverse mindset and the possibility mindset. I like it, the possibility mindset. The idea of actually always thinking it's possible. It is possible, right? Whenever it's developing the things, I can grow, I can cultivate optimism, I can learn resilience, I can do these exercises. So that's an important thing, to actually believe in our own ability to do it, right? Which leads me to another very crucial ability, and that's the part I want to sort of share with you a few stories about the Rebbe. It's also the ability just to look at things differently, right? Because as I say, the negative things don't go away. That's not how resilience works. The pain doesn't go away, the negative things don't go away. The situation doesn't change. Sometimes it does, sometimes we can change it, but not always, right? So often, what we're looking at or what we experience is what it is. It's really about our ability to reframe, right? It's our ability to look at things a little bit differently. And I'll just share with you, I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds and thousands of stories like this, but this is something that I, among the many things, the Rebbe in his, he became the Rebbe in 1950, passed away in 1994. And there was a number of underlying themes that just ran through his leadership, right? You have to understand, when he became the Rebbe in 1950, this was not long after the Holocaust, right? Rabbi Sacks writes about this. Rabbi Sacks had a very strong connection to the Rebbe. He has told the famous story. The Rebbe encouraged him to enter the rabbinate and become the leader, a leader. And he writes, he did a book on the Rebbe's talks and the Rebbe's sichot and so on, and he writes about his, he writes that in the 1940s and the 1950s, of course, was after the war, and the Jewish nation as a whole was shattered, right? So you can imagine that at that time, especially as people had moved from Europe to America, Yiddishkeit, Judaism was very underdeveloped in America in general at that time. There wasn't a lot of hope. There wasn't a lot of hope at all, right? I mean, that's just, and there was a lot of, but, you know, Jewish people pick up, as I said, the first one I did the series, that collectively we have a lot of resilience, but it takes individuals to cultivate that resilience, right? So he was intolerant completely, I would say, of any notion that there's, that we can't do this, right? That it cannot be rebuilt, or we cannot inspire people, we cannot lift people up. There was no, every challenge by him was an opportunity. Every challenge. There was no such thing as a challenge standing in the way, right? One of the sayings he would repeat hundreds and hundreds of times is a saying that came from he was the seventh Rebbe, this came from the fourth Rebbe, called Rebbe Maharash, who had a Yiddish saying like this. He said, the Rebbe Maharash used to say, but I don't think he made such a life thing about it. He just said it a few times when the Rebbe took the saying and made it like a whole life philosophy. He used to say that the Welt sagt, he says, the world says like this. It sounds a lot better in Yiddish, but I'll try and explain this. He says, the world says that when you come to an obstacle, amikenish darunter geht men ariber. If you can't go underneath, let's say you're trying to go somewhere and there's a table in the way, there's something in the way, right? So the world says, if you can't go underneath, then you jump over. In other words, you negotiate first, you try, you move in it. And ich zog, he says, and I say, lechatchil ariber, just jump over to begin with. Just ignore the obstacle, right? Just jump over. So this became like the lifelong sort of view that challenge, okay, so there's a challenge. There's greater strength. It means you can do it. It means if you find yourself in a more challenging thing, not that the challenge doesn't exist, it just means you have greater strength. You should say that every challenge that a person gets, it means that God has given that person greater strength to be able to overcome it. Right? And Baim was like a simple belief. So, and based on that, he would often use simple situations to reframe them in very, very sort of simple but profound ways. So one story I read was a person there was a bunch of young men, American, when the Rebbe first became Rebbe in the 1950, there was a group of young men, American men, who came from a very, very secular background. And they sort of became closer to Judaism, and they started to study in the Rebbe's yeshiva. And one of them was a student from Chicago. His name is Mendel Greenbaum. And a few months after he joined the yeshiva, he got his draft notice. You know, there was draft by selection then, and he was called up to the army, and he was devastated. He says, because, like he said to his friends, you know, it's funny. Like last few years when I wasn't involved in Judaism at all and I wasn't doing any mitzvot or anything, they left me alone. Now suddenly I'm found, you know, where I feel comfortable and I'm studying and I want to progress my studies and progress in my connection to Jewish practice and observance and mitzvot and so on. Suddenly I get called, you know, think, okay. So he was very, very upset and he asked for an audience with the Rebbe and he went into the Rebbe and shared his, and he also was afraid that if he goes to the army it's going to affect him and he's going to not be so inspired, so he'll lose that enthusiasm and so on and so forth. So the Rebbe just looked at him and said, sometimes in life one must take a step backward in order to be able to go forward in the future. That was it. So the young man, Mendel Greenbaum, just remained silent, but he was a bit puzzled. He's not sure where the Rebbe was going with this. So the Rebbe saw that he was surprised, so he got up from his desk and he took a chair next to him. And he said to this young man, he said, if I wanted to jump over this chair, I couldn't do it because I'm standing right in front of it. But if I'll just take a few steps back and get a running start, I can gain the momentum required to clear the obstacle. Right? So that was the imagery. You have to go back in order to jump over. So he said to him, you're going to a place now where... So again, it's taking a situation which is not changing. He was going to join the army, right? There wasn't an option. Which means he wouldn't be learning in yeshiva and he wouldn't be progressing himself. So it's a step back, right? He said. So he told him, so that step back is just to run faster. So therefore, what should you do? He said, what you need to do is become a leader. You need to now engage in Jewish students that you find in the army. Share with them, teach them, inspire them, and become stronger, right? That's your mission, obviously. Maybe, ideally, your mission would be to stay in yeshiva and learn, but obviously not. If God has put you in a situation which seems like a step back, it's just a step back to run faster. So he told him that that's what you have to do. So he followed his advice. He started to reach out to dozens of other students. And it became like his whole thing, like throughout his life. He stayed in touch with many of these people and he had a tremendous impact and influence, right? So it was just, the situation was exactly the same, but in his worldview, in the Rebbe's worldview, there was no such thing as, oh, this is terrible. If it's hashgacha pratit, if that's what you're supposed to do, then, and even if it is a step back, it's a step back to run faster, right? Which is very similar to a story which I think I've told you. In 1977, the Rebbe suffered a very big heart attack at the time. And it was towards the end of Sukkot, on Shemini Atzeret, and so on. And then one time, a doctor was taking blood for a blood test, I guess, or something, and was drawing blood from the veins. And the Rebbe asked him, what is it that draws the blood from the veins, right? So the doctor says it's the vacuum in the syringe. The fact that you create a vacuum in the syringe draws more blood. So one of the Rebbe's secretaries was standing there. So the Rebbe turned to his secretary and says, oh, that's an amazing thing. That's exactly what I've always been thinking. And it's just something that I've told someone lately. Someone came to me lately or wrote to me lately that he's feeling very down and he's feeling very empty and he's feeling like nothing. You know, like we all have those feelings once in a while. And the Rebbe wrote back to him and said, that's great. Because when you're feeling it, it's like a real rebreath. If you're feeling empty, that means you're not attached to anything. There's a vacuum. A vacuum draws more blood, more life, more vitality. Right? I mean, it's an interesting thing. How many of us would think about feeling empty and down, like, right? And that thing. So he says, you're feeling empty, okay? It means you've created a space. In other words, what does that mean? It means sometimes we're not empty. We're feeling very fulfilled and we're doing stuff. But then when we're always constantly doing stuff and focused on things, that means we're blocking out other stuff, other things, other opportunities, because we're very focused on what we're doing, because we haven't created that space. Sometimes when we end up feeling down, no one looks to feel down, no one looks to have a feeling of emptiness. But when you do, you have to look at it as an opportunity. You've created a space, so now it means you can fill it with anything. So it's creative vitality, right? Just that. And this is what Rabbi Sacks also writes. He says that one of the themes he saw come through the Rebbe's teachings, because he wrote a book on the Rebbe's talks. He said, I began to see how the theme ran like a connecting thread through many of his talks, the idea of Yeridat Sorech Aliyah, that every descent is for the purpose of ascent, right? This was the underlying rule. That if someone has an experience where they are challenged or they experience a descent in whatever it is, it's always part of the rebuilding process. In other words, always to come out stronger. It's like you knock down a building in order to rebuild another one that's even greater. You know, there's an interesting law in the laws of shuls, right? So in Shulchan Aruch, it has a whole section where it talks about towns that build shuls, right? So they build the shuls for the town and so on. And there's a whole halachic question whether you're allowed to demolish a shul, right? Without going into the times when you can or you can't, whatever the case is. But one very interesting law is that, so the baseline law is you're not allowed to demolish a shul. Comes from the Torah, you're not allowed to demolish anything in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. You're not allowed to demolish a shul, it's a place of holiness. With one exception. You're allowed to demolish a shul if you plan to build a nicer one in the same place. So what does it mean? You still demolished it. Because then we get taught, when you demolish a shul to build a nicer one, the demolishing wasn't demolishing. It's not destructive. It's part of the building. The destroying the building is part of the building a beautiful one. So it's not called demolishing. Understand? And that's how it is in life. So you take a few steps back, it's to run faster. You have a space of emptiness, it's to fill it with something greater. Yeridah, if you have a descent, it's for the aliyah, right? And I guess that's a real mindset to develop, but it comes, I guess, through some of the things you spoke about before, some of those exercises, to always have that ability, to practice that ability, to look at the positive side of things, look at the opportunity and the challenge rather than focus on the challenge, and so on and so forth, right? There's a beautiful story of just about reframing, of a lady who, I don't know who she is, her name is Mrs. Shandel Itkin. No, her name's not Itkin, her name is, her maiden name was Itkin. No, I've forgotten what her name is now, but, well, that's strange, I don't know, I forget that. Anyway, she's today the principal, I think she's still the principal, she's quite an older woman really. She was my wife's principal, She's a principal of the main girls' school in the Chabad girls' school in New York, right? Which is now massive. It's got thousands of kids. She was one of the first students in that school. That school started, I'm not sure what year, but it was very early on in the Rebbe's teachings. And when the Rebbe became the Rebbe, there was no Chabad girls' school, so the girls went to other schools, other Jewish schools, whatever. And then one day they decided they were establishing a school, and they decided to. It's called Beth Rivka. And they started the school, and this was the Chabad school in New York, the main Chabad school in New York. And her father, he was a very strong fellow of the Rebbe, and obviously he was going to send her to that school. And she protested. She says, no, she doesn't want to go. She's very happy in her school. And she's not interested in who, and she doesn't want to go to a new school. She doesn't want to be, she doesn't want to be a guinea pig. No? Why should she be from the first? So the father was, the father said, well, maybe, you know what, he wanted her to go to that school, but maybe we should ask the Rebbe, So she wrote a letter to the Rebbe, and she says later she was quite strong, she was a teenager, and she had the confidence to do that. And she wrote all that other thing, she's not interested, she's very happy in a school, she doesn't want to go to this new school, her father and parents wanted to go. And she ended off the letter by saying, I don't want to be a guinea pig. That's it, then end of letter, signed the letter and sent it in. A couple of days later, an answer came back from the Rebbe. One word. What was the one word? It's such a depth of reframing. The Rebbe crossed out the word guinea pig and wrote chalutza, pioneer. Not a guinea pig, you're a pioneer. Which teenager doesn't want to be a pioneer? Everything changed. She went to the school, she enjoyed the school, she was successful, she helped build the school, and then she became the principal of the school, eventually, right? But it's such an amazing thing. It can be the exact same experience, right? It's just, how do you look at it? Guinea pig means it's a negative thing, I'm being experimented on. Pioneer means I have the fortune to be part of something amazing and build something new. Same experience. It's an incredible thing. And that was the thing. Talking about, I'll just end off with one story and then we'll draw the raffle. About using opportunities, right? So there was a person called, I don't know, maybe you know who it is, but there was a person called Shirley Kisholm or something. I'm not sure how you pronounce that name. And in 1968, she was a black woman. She was elected to be New York's 12th congressional district in the Congress, whatever. And you know, works in Congress. Each congressperson represents a certain district. And her district happened to be Crown Heights, which is where the Chabad movement, including on there. And she was it was an amazing thing because it was the first African-American woman that was elected to Congress and so on. However, she very quickly found out that actually it wasn't so simple. There was still quite a bit of racism going around. And although she was elected, but she wasn't given much power or influence. And what they did was, there was pressure from the more radical and racist sort of factions of Congress. They appointed her to like an agricultural committee where she had really very little influence. Like it was, and she was very, very upset and very, very frustrated. One day, she wanted to take care of a lot of things. There was a lot of poverty in New York. She wanted to take care of it and just didn't have the power to do anything, basically. So she was elected, but it was a figurehead only. And then came a call from the Rebbe's office. The Rebbe's office reached out to her and said that the Rebbe would like to see you. She said, okay. So she came to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said to her, I know you're very upset, because the Rebbe used to be up to date with what's happening and stuff. Yes, she answered, I'm deeply insulted. What should I do? So the Rebbe said the following, what a blessing God has given you. I guess with the agricultural appointment, why is it a blessing? The country has so much surplus food, and there are so many hungry people. You can use this gift that God gave you in your current position to feed hungry people. Find a creative way of doing it. In other words, same message. Why are you upset? Agricultural committee is for a reason. There must be a reason. There's a lot of hungry people in the thing, a lot of surplus food. Find a way to make a shidduch, right? So she had this in mind, and then she happened to meet, on her first day in Washington, she met a senator called Bob Dole. And he was from the Midwest, and he talked to her, and he said he was looking for help for Midwestern farmers who were losing money on their crops. He said, Americans have started purchasing produce from Cuba, the senator told her. As a result of those imports, our farmers are losing business. Now they have a huge surplus of unsold food, and we don't know what to do with it. Ah, she thought, the Rebbe's advice. Right? So the next few years, Kislam worked to expand the National Food Stamp Program, which allowed poor Americans to buy subsidized food from Midwestern farmers. Finally, in 1973, the Agricultural and Consumer Protection Act, which made food stamps available for people who are known as a nutrition program for women, infants, and children, known as WIC, right, which she established together with the Senator Dole, which today benefits more than 8 million people each month, right? And she says, she wrote her late, she said, when she retired, at a retirement party, she said, I owe all of this to a rabbi who was an optimist, who taught me that what you think is a challenge is actually a gift from God. And if poor babies have milk and poor children have food today, it's because of this rabbi in Crown Heights had a vision, right? This is just again, one of the many aspects of his leadership, but this was an incredible one. There was no such thing as impossible. You want to talk about possibility mindset, this like was amazing. Things that everyone laughed at, things would never work, things that people scoffed at later saw that it flourished and blossomed. I mean, the whole network thing of all over the world, of having a center, you know, all these things. And it's an amazing lesson. I just wanted to share that with you because, as I said, this Shabbos is his Yahrzeit, and it's a beautiful lesson to learn, to practice looking at everything that we think is a challenge as a real opportunity. That everything that comes our way, to see the good and to see it as not as a challenge, which is damaging, but as an opportunity from which we can grow. So just to, before we draw the raffle, just to remind you that, what did I say? What was the date? 21st. 21st is the next lesson. I'll circle the topic. And for now, raffle. Thank you, Mrs. Letterman. And thank you, Mrs. Letterman, for all the hard work she does in the raffle. The raffle was, thank God, successful. And thank you to all of those who participated and bought more than one. And really amazing. Okay. There's a Welsh shook it up. What's that? It's always been a good shake, I promise, right? Okay, so there were three raffles on the raffle. This for this 2022 raffle. So we'll go from the third prize up to the first prize. And the third prize is a $500 Kohl's voucher. And the winner in this year's raffle is... It is... Ari Jackson.
Whoa,
Ari Jackson, who's engaged, whose grandmother's here. Wish her mazel tov, getting married in a few weeks. In a few, yeah. Okay. Now we go to the second prize. Second prize is a $1,000 voucher to the Supercenter Moor Park, which was donated by Supercenter. And the winner this year for that second prize is... Frank Adler. That's Rona's son.
Rona's son.
I believe.
Frank.
Yep.
Second.
Is that Frank Adler? Is that?
Oh,
this is different Frank Adler.
Frank Adler from Central.
Oh, is it Frank Adler from Central? Oh, sorry. Okay. Oh. Same name. I'll have to call. I'll call them. We'll see which one it is. Okay. And the final prize, which is the first prize, which is the 1500 voucher to Westfield, donated by a center group, is Zalman Castell. Rabbi Castell. Very nice. Thank you very, very much, everyone.
Thank you.
We have a little break now for 2 weeks, and then we'll be back with more.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're very welcome.
Saying to the upside, and it can bounce around, but I don't know much about the history, but it's exactly what you're saying.
Was it a focus on trying to look at the good part? Yeah.
Wear these t-shirts.
That's very relevant. It's always, this topic is always relevant for everyone.